sacred and secular pieces, and also some popular street songs. So off to Naples in the early music show at 1 o'clock today here on BBC Radio 3. That's after this week's edition of Private Passions with Michael Bartley.
The actor and director Ian McDiarmid is very much a man of the theatre, despite his film appearances, most notably in the Star Wars trilogies. He and Jonathan Kent ran, enormously successfully, the Almeida Theatre for some 13 years. Did music enter your life quite early? Did you hear sounds that fascinated you?
I was aware of music really through my grandmother. I'd heard that she could play the piano, but she played it by ear, which seemed an extraordinary thing to me then. Still quite surprising, I think, that people have that ability. And I never heard her play because by the time I was able to listen to things, she had rheumatoid arthritis and couldn't play anymore. And then at school, we got to go to the occasional concert given specially for young people by the Scottish National Orchestra. And I remember first being impressed not by the sound of the music, but by the conductor. It was Alexander Gibson, who was, as I subsequently discovered, a very fine conductor. But he had a presence about him, and he wore his tails with distinction. And all of these things made a terrific impression on me. And the fact that he could raise his baton, and then these extraordinary sounds came out. So that was a source of fascination to me as a young boy, and I suppose in a sense it was a theatrical impulse.
I was going to say, yes, it was a theatre. One of the reasons we asked you to take part in the programme, apart from your theatrical successes anyway, which would have made you an interesting subject, was that we read you saying that what you might have been in another world would have been a singer, so that you could have realised the operatic parts Britain created for Piers.
I did say that, and it's true. I've always admired singers and been thrilled by them, particularly singer-actors. I don't just mean singers who are good at acting too. There's something singer-actors bring that actors can't bring on their own. I mean, that's obvious in a way, but it seems to me to have a higher power. And the parts that have, many of them have fascinated me over the years, but particularly Britain's complicated characters, and they tend to be the parts that he wrote with Peter Peer's voice in mind, and no doubt aspects of his personality as well. And the complicated nature of these roles has always fascinated me. And every time I've seen one of the operas, I've been impressed and also slightly envious. I think, well, yes, it would be fine if that was a part in a play, and of course I'd love to play it, but I wouldn't be able to dig as deep as the singer I'm listening to is digging.
Well, we'll come on to the operas in a moment, but it's actually orchestral, instrumental music that we're going to hear first.
Yes, and Benjamin Britten. Again, he was an early influence, if I can put it that way. I mean, fortunately, the first, I think I'm right in saying, musical piece I heard was, fortuitously, The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, conducted by Alexander Gibson. And then later on, I came across the Piano Concerto, which I loved, and was as surprised by that, I suppose, although it was, I suppose, in my 20s when I first heard it, as I was by the initial sounds of an orchestra. I was amazed that such a controlled form could yield such diverse results, and the four movements are quite different from each other. And I was very surprised to find that the second movement was a waltz, and delighted by it too. And also thought that this is not an easy romantic thing. There's something more going on here. Yes, it's very seductive and yet somehow ironic.
Funnily enough, there are traces of the operatic composer in there, aren't there?
I felt that. I'm interested you should say that. I sort of feel at this time he's moving towards writing an opera. I mean, how would I know? And he does.
Obviously. Especially, I think, you know, right at the beginning, those kind of little sort of whimsical flourishes in the woodwind.
Yes.
Which permeate the operatic writing too.
Yes, yes. And he himself seduces or invites you to think of something one way and then slightly moves direction.
That was the second movement, The Waltz, from the Britten Piano Concerto, and we heard Sviatoslav Richter playing the piano with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by the composer Benjamin Britten. Well, on to the operas then, Ian McDiarmid. And the one you've chosen is not, and I'm very pleased about this in some ways, the most obvious.
No, I love the most obvious, if by that you mean Peter Grimes, for all the obvious reasons, not least the sea, which obsesses me, perhaps in the way that it certainly did the very young Briton when he first listened to Frank Bridge's piece, and that set him off in all sorts of directions.
Well, you've not eschewed the sea, have you?
No, I have not. Billy Budd, yes, the man of war, the indomitable, is the centre and the central metaphor of the opera. The other thing that fascinated me about this, and it's the thing I've seen most recently, I think I'd come across it before at Covent Garden, but I had a terrible seat, so I couldn't really see and couldn't really listen. But that wasn't the case not so long ago when I went to Glyndebourne to see the marvellous production directed by Michael Grandage and wonderfully conducted by Mark Elder. And I thought, oh yes, of course, this is a masterpiece to equal Peter Grimes. Why should one be in any doubt about that? But because I didn't know it as well, I was regularly surprised by it. And I think that's one of the things I really love about music, being regularly ambushed by it, thinking, oh my God, I didn't realise. And where does all that passion come from? Naive responses like that, but that's what I was having as I watched it. And then I thought, I haven't read this book, this novella. So I got hold of it and read it and was fascinated to discover that, in fact, the piece we're going to hear, the words of that are not Eric Crozier's or E.M. Forster's, who are responsible for the libretto, but Melville's himself. And that actually it started as a ballad. He wrote the novella later. So the words that we're here of this particular piece are all Melville's, with the odd excision and interpolation and repetition, but not many of them. And that is, of course, how he finishes the novella. He'd be amazed, and I'm sure delighted, that it finished up in a great opera.
Just explain what's happening at this moment when we join the opera.
Yes, Billy has been condemned to death because he murdered Claggett. He did it accidentally. He tried to express his feelings and being wronged by Claggett, and he unfortunately has a stammer, and the stammer gets the better of him, and because he can't express himself, he hits Claggett, who dies to everyone's consternation. Therefore, he has to be punished by Captain Vere. It's the law of the sea. Or is it? One asks. Anyway, Captain Vere decides that's what has to happen, against perhaps his initial instincts. And Billy has been condemned to death and is thinking about the next day's hanging.
very pared down, that. And interestingly enough, we were talking about the kind of filigree work of the woodwind and the piano concerto.
Yes,
and there it
there
was
you
again.
Are. Yes, and I hadn't realised that until I heard it again just now.
That was the aria "Look Through the Port Comes the Moonshine Astray," also known as "Billy and the Darbies," from Act 2, Scene 3 of Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd. We heard Simon Keenly's side with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Richard Hickox. Now, just as some roles impart that kind of otherness, if you like, that something which takes you into another dimension, so do certain actors and singers, and it's one of those that we're turning to now.
Yes, I completely agree with your description of Janet Baker. I'd read, before I saw her, that she had this quality, and I wanted to see her, I wanted to see it for myself and listen to it, and I did. I was fortunate enough to see her in a couple of concerts before her retirement. When she walked on the stage, she has a kind of presence, that's fine, many, many fine performers have that. She began singing, it was very beautiful, marvellously technically accomplished. But there was something else going on. And now we get into the sort of difficult area, the sort of indefinable area, but nonetheless, I'll try and talk about it. It's not a possession, but it's a kind of possession. It's better than an occupation. Something happens to the performer as a result of their gift and the music in the moment that evening. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but sometimes it does. And when it does, it communicates itself in an electric fashion to the audience. And that happened several times in the concerts that I saw Janet Baker give. And listening to her on record now, I can feel some of that too, even though we're not in the same room.
Ganze Welt.
It's a marvellous setting of a lyric. Goethe's words, of course, from the great play. Well, it's not a great play, actually. It's a great dramatic poem, and it's full of richness and difficulty. But Gretchen expresses herself personally, in soliloquy, in a sense, through song, most poignantly. And, of course, Goethe didn't write any music, but Schubert has. And Janet Baker, in that very short song, takes you through the full tragic progress, regress, perhaps, of the part. And that's an astonishing and wonderful thing.
Gretchen am Spinnrade by Schubert, Janet Baker and Gerald Moore. Now, during your time at the Almeida, Ian, and since, there was quite a lot of contemporary music, actually.
There was. There was a very celebrated international festival of contemporary music, which our predecessor, Pierre Audi, marvellously got together. And when we came, we wanted that to continue, but in a way that would mean something to us as artistic directors. But we thought, well, we don't know that much about contemporary music, but the thing that interests us most, Jonathan Kent and myself, is the relationship between words and music. So perhaps we'll try and do more contemporary opera, which is what we did. Mm. We formed a very fruitful partnership with E&O, with David Pountney in particular, and Henrietta Breeden. And when he left that company, we took a deep breath and strode out on our own.
And the Almeida Opera actually pioneered quite a lot of new work, which
yes,
traveled. And...
Yes, not least Thomas Addis. And you know this well, Michael, because you at Cheltenham and the Almeida jointly commissioned his first opera, Powder Her Face, which was a wonderful, unexpected, all the things we've been talking about today, I mean, with a light tone in it, but with a very dark underbelly. And it shocked quite a lot of people, which is always satisfying. But but more than that, it was a really fine piece of music by a potentially great composer. So I'm rather proud of our collaboration in that respect. And Tom Addis used to come regularly to the Almeida and see the plays, and I know one of the plays he saw was The Tempest. And he was thinking that time about writing his next opera, which turned out to be The Tempest. So we're not claiming responsibility, but perhaps we helped him think about it in a different way. And I almost chose, because it's a great piece, the great quintet in the last act of that.
But you, in fact, chose, very loyally, a Scottish contemporary composer.
Yes, yes, not just because he's Scots. We have that in common. He's a passionate man. I hope we have that in common, too. He's perhaps more expressive than I am of that. And he's a Roman Catholic, which I certainly am not. But I've admired his music, and it was interesting. I did. You were talking earlier about parts that one could bring something to. I had the temerity to adapt a novel by Andrew O'Hagan called Be Near Me, principally because the leading character I thought was a marvellous part. And that was the initial motivation, and then other things came to play. The National Theatre of Scotland agreed to put it on, John Tiffany to direct it, all of which was very exciting. And when we had an early reading, John said, "There's a scene missing." I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yes, the character I play, his mother, needs to meet the woman who is his housekeeper. I'd love to see a scene between these two women and him. So would you mind writing it?" I said, "No, I can't possibly do that. It's not in the book." And he said, "Well, you're a writer now. You'll have to do..." And I was in a state of panic. And I went back on the train to where I live from Glasgow, where we were rehearsing. And I thought, well, I've no idea how to do this. And then I thought, because there's a lot of music in the play and the central character is obsessed with Chopin, rather pretentiously. He doesn't really like him. He doesn't know what he likes, but he likes to think he likes him. And this infuriates the local Scots who surround him and so on. But then I thought, well, I wonder what his mother's taste in music would be. And I thought, well, she's a progressive woman. She's always wanted him to think more positively and more progressively than he does. And who would she like? I thought, well, she'd probably like someone like James Macmillan. I thought, hang on a minute. He's Roman Catholic, which was germane to the play because I was playing a Roman Catholic priest and so on. And before I knew where I was, thinking about that, I found I'd written a scene. So I'm very grateful to him in lots of ways. I also knew that he was writing a Passion, a St. John, and that I wouldn't be able to get to see it because I was in this play. But I got hold of the recording as soon as I could and was quite overwhelmed by it. Here's someone who matches his passions to the great passion itself.
Thank you. Christ's Garments Divided, from the St. John Passion by James Macmillan, the London Symphony Chorus and Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. One of the ways in which I suppose I'd characterise a lot of the roles you've done and a lot of the work you did, Ian McDiarmid, at the Almeida, was kind of anarchic and dangerous quality in the best creative sense of that. And it seems to me that there was no better vehicle for those qualities, because they were about danger and anarchy, in David Pountney's E&O production of Lady Macbeth and Sense, which you want to have next.
Yes, it was remarkable. I was, all of those clichés apply, I was knocked sideways, blown away by it. And the variety and intensity of the production matched the variety and intensity of the music. He called it a tragedy satire. And that's something I know immediately appealed to David, and something he's very good at. So he knew where he was going from the beginning and gave us the most extraordinary evening in the theatre. Shostakovich, he's a genius. He just manages to combine the horrific, the erotic, the exotic, the emotional, the psychological, the intellectual on a regular basis, but to provide you at the end of the evening with a sense of completeness.
La куда я отсюда не пойду.
Свёкор двери запрёт.
Доброму молодцу и окна дверь. А ну, Котя!
That's the end of Act One of Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk. We heard Galina Vishnyaskaya singing Katerina Ismailova, Nikolai Gedda, Sergei, and Dimitar Petkov as Boris Ismailov. And the London Philharmonic Orchestra were conducted by Mstislav Rostropovich. For you, Ian McDiarmid, I imagine there is music in the spoken voice.
Yes, yes, absolutely so. It's interesting, I think there's a lot of discussion these days about young actors. Can they speak the verse and all that? The answer is yes, they can. It would be better if they had more opportunities to do so, and they'd be the first to echo that, I think. But I think in this age of almost obsessive naturalism, and that can be good, certain other values to do with speech are in danger of getting lost. It's not naturalism on one side and high-flown mannerist speaking on the other, although it can be. There is a middle ground, and if you're speaking great verse, you have to attend to that fact as well as the feelings and thoughts of what you're saying, and I feel that there could be more of that. I have chosen Robert Donat speaking on Westminster Bridge. My father used to say, before I knew who Robert Donat was, that he was the finest speaker of English that he'd heard. John Gielgud was fine, but Robert Donat could really speak the language. So I did go out and buy a recording of his in which he speaks sonnets. And this, not the most distinguished poem that Wordsworth ever wrote, but he speaks it in the way I've just described. Also, it evokes London, where I've spent most of my life.
Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning. Silent, bare, ships, towers, domes, theatres and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt, a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Robert Donat reading On Westminster Bridge by Wordsworth. And there's the confidence, or the relaxation that confidence allows there in the voice, isn't there?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's a voice of its time. We wouldn't say majesty now, and that will put some people off when they hear it. But they shouldn't be. They should just attend to the other values. Mm. And you're right, it comes out of his relaxation with the words, as well as his beautiful voice and his ability to speak it. The way he says dear God, you hardly hear the D consonant at all, but you hear it. Mm. And it's moving.
We're going to put together now, Ian, two bits of Burns, one sung and one read.
Yes. Well, you'd think I'd have to choose Burns, wouldn't I? But I do it with real pleasure. He was a great poet. He was an extraordinary man. In some ways, he embodied many of the things we've been talking about. He was a shapeshifter. He moved all the time. And his poetry moves into all of those areas we've been discussing, sometimes with great success, sometimes with total failure. And when he sort of aspired to be an Englishman, when he got sort of Dr. Johnsonian, some of it's really crass and sentimental. But when he was writing in his Ayrshire Scots, some of it is absolutely unbeatable. And he manages to do, once always longing to hear this, and indeed to do it, to conjure up a feeling which is at the same time simple but not sentimental. And I think he does that in A Fond Kiss. It doesn't need to be sung. It can be beautifully spoken. Tom Fleming was a great speaker of his work. And the thing is, he's also provided, in a sense, a lyric, so that it can exist on its own as a poem, but it's not in any way damaged. In fact, it might even be enhanced by being sung, set to a great old traditional air that I'm afraid I can't remember the name of. But again, an unbeatable match, rather like the Goethe and Schubert. And it's sung by Kenneth McKellar, and he and Tom Fleming both lately died, and they were good friends. And I first saw Kenneth McKellar in Variety. Here we are again, unlikely collisions. He came on sometimes with the comic, Johnny Beattie, and sometimes after, for a moment of pathos. And he might well, in what I would now cringe to describe, a very tartan setting, covered in tartan, unbelievable tartans too, not real ones, but sort of pink ones and blue ones and overlit ones. And, you know, no shortbread tin has ever looked like those tartans. And he would sing this song. And in spite of, or maybe even because of it a little, one was moved.
Well, he's preceded by Tom Fleming.
Yea, fond kiss, and then we sever. Yea, farewell, and then forever. Deep in heart-wrung tears I'll pledge thee. Warring sighs and groans I'll wage thee. Who shall say that fortune grieves him while the star of hope she leaves him? Me, nae cheerfu' twinkle lichts me. Dark despair aroond benechts me. I'll ne'er blame my partial fancy. Nothing could resist my Nancy. But to see her was to love her, love but her, and love forever. Had we never loved sae kindly, had we never loved sae blindly, never met or never parted, we had ne'er been broken-hearted. Fare thee weel, thou first and fairest. Fare thee weel, thou best and dearest. Thine be ilka joy and treasure, peace, enjoyment, love and pleasure. Yea, fond kiss, and then we sever. Yea, farewell, alas, forever. Deep in heart-wrung tears I'll pledge thee. Warring sighs and groans I'll wage thee.
Oh,
a clutch of fond kisses there. Thanks to Kenneth McKellar and Patricia Cahill, and before them, Tom Fleming. We're going to conclude, Ian, with a piece which I think makes you think of putting on a play in some ways. It has a kind of analogy.
Yes, it does. It's 24 hours in the life of three sailors. 1944. The war was still on when this musical was first produced on the town. And they seek what you would imagine they'd seek, as the lyric puts it, sights, nights, lights, mainly women. And then they leave. But that's not the end of the story, because three more sailors come on for another 24 hours. And it is a bit like doing a play when people get together, actors and the company, in extraordinary intimate ways because of the nature of the work, for a very short period of time, and then they disappear. But then another group comes along. That's marvellous, and there's a spirit of that in this show. It's also very much about New York. If Westminster Bridge is my feelings about London, this is certainly everybody's feeling about New York.
Pretty guy, look, pixie, hey, jump up with a teen. And a guy, look, pixie, hey, jump up with a girl, look, pixie, hey, jump up with a girl, look, pixie, hey, jump up with a teen. Scared of where you see the pretty guy look big, say, hey, give up with a date. Or a guy look big, say, hey, give up with a girl look big, say, hey, give up with a guy look big, say, hey, give up with a date. Pretty guy look big, say, hey, give up with a date. Or a guy look big, say, hey, give up with a girl look big, say, hey, give up with a guy look big, say, hey, give up with a date.
Thank you. It's 6 o'clock.
Come on, fellas. Let's get back to the ship.
Wonderful joie de vivre in that, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It's ecstasy and pathos sit side by side.
We heard The Dance, The Real Coney Island, and the finale from Bernstein's On the Town, the ensemble, chorus and orchestra directed by the composer, Leonard Bernstein. Well, Ian McDiarmid, I suppose that really the great joy of your life, in a sense, is that you've done such contrasting things. I mean, I don't imagine that you ever saw Dennis Thatcher at the Almeida, but on the other hand, you portrayed him on television.
Yes, yes, I did. And there wasn't very much, I think that was in my favour, to go on. I mean, he didn't, very sensibly, he kept in the background, he wouldn't be interviewed, except he did give one interview to his daughter, Carol, which was captured on DVD, and which, of course, I watched. But I thought, if I play it like that, I'll never work again. It was so extreme.
Well, I'm very glad to report to all of those fans of Star Wars that you are an extremely gentle and personable person. Thank you very much for introducing us to these pieces of music that mean so much to you.
Thank you.
Ian McDiarmid was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the Liberal Democrat peer, Baroness Shirley Williams. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. Today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall. Well, in a couple of minutes, today's Early Music Show. Catherine Bott presents a programme exploring the music of 18th century Naples, a city that offered creative opportunities to such composers as Alessandro Scarlatti and his son Domenico, along with Pergolesi, Porpora and Durante. The music includes a variety of sacred and secular pieces and popular street songs. That's the Early Music Show, just after the 1 o'clock news. Right now, a word from Bettany Hughes.
AD 410. 1600 years ago. It's the traditional date for the end of Roman rule in Britain. Some think of that demise of empire with a certain romantic sadness. Yet we were a subject people in an occupied land. How did we develop such a cosy notion of our imperial overlords? Join me, Bettany Hughes, to explore the beginnings of that special relationship and the many ways native Britons reacted to the occupation as it was happening, in this week's Radio 3 Sunday feature, Becoming Roman, the first of our two-part series, The Romans in Britain, starting at 9:30.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio, and you can also listen to us live online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news read by Ian Skelly.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has confirmed that there will be some form of a cap on university tuition fees in England. Earlier this month, a review by Lord Brown recommended that there should be no limit on what students pay. But Mr Clegg said he was uneasy about that idea and he wanted to see something he described as more restrained. The Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, Douglas Alexander, has said he backs in principle the government's plan to replace all out-of-work benefits with a single universal credit payment. Mr. Alexander called the idea sensible and admitted that Labour could have done more to reduce the number of people claiming incapacity benefit, but he said the coalition's spending review hit the poor hardest. In Haiti, the first cases of cholera have been detected in the capital, Port-au-Prince. More than 200 people have already died in the north of the country. Aid agencies are trying to prevent the disease reaching makeshift camps, where more than a million people who survived January's earthquake are sheltering. Three men from the southeast of England have died in a helicopter crash in Northern Ireland. The pilot and two passengers were on their way home from a day's shooting in County Fermanagh yesterday when the helicopter came down in the Mourne Mountains. The nuclear-powered submarine, which was grounded off the Isle of Skye, is now returning to its base at Faslane. HMS Astute became stuck on a shingle bank during sea trials on Friday. The Ministry of Defence says the vessel is expected to arrive on the Clyde tomorrow when she'll be checked for damage. International experts in rock art have appealed for proper protection to be given to ancient cave paintings and stone carvings in the Sahara Desert. The experts said that unless action was taken to protect the work from vandalism and looting, an important window on human history could be lost. And the weather, there'll be plenty of sunshine in many areas this afternoon, but there'll be scattered showers in northeast Scotland and down eastern counties of England, where there'll also be a chilly breeze. And that's the BBC News and the weather. The time now is 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, time now on Radio 3 to join Catherine Bott for the early music show, which today has a Neapolitan flavour.
Naples, thou heart of men which ever pantest naked beneath the lidless eye of heaven. Elysian city, which to calm enchantest the mutinous air and sea, they round thee even as sleep round love are driven. Metropolis of a ruined paradise, long lost, late won, and yet but half regained. two movements from Alessandro Scarlatti's Sonata No. 9 in A minor, played by Dan Lorin and London Baroque. Benvenuto a Napoli. Refreshing, isn't it, to have those lines from Shelley's Ode to Naples at the top of the programme, instead of the usual old See Naples and Die. Today we're visiting, musically at any rate, a southern Italian city which is home to the purest, historically informed pizza recipes, a city with a famous street of artisan workshops making traditional presepi, or nativity scenes. Naples is a port founded by the ancient Greeks in the 8th century BC, and it's always been a fulcrum for new ideas. Over the centuries, its palaces and churches have played a vital part in the history of Italian music. Now, if someone says the music of Naples, what comes into your mind's ear today? The waspish drone of mopeds? The strumming of a mandolin? Well, pre-moped, 18th century Naples offered wonderful creative and professional opportunities not only to the man whose music began the show today, Alessandro Scarlatti, and his son Domenico, but also Francesco Durante, Giovanni Battista Pergolesi, and Nicola Antonio Porpora. And if we go a little further back in music history to the very beginning of the Baroque, there's a truly great composer whose life was as infamous as his music was revolutionary, the aristocratic Carlo Gesualdo, Prince of Venosa, Count of Conza, born in Naples in 1561. It was in his home city in 1586 that he married his cousin, Maria d'Avalos, the daughter of the Marquis of Pescara. 4 years later, he caught Maria in flagrante delicto di fragrante peccato, or red-handed in scented sin, sounds more fun in the original, with her lover, the Duke of Andrea, and hacked both of them to death with the help of his servants. The scandal was immense, and Gesualdo, seemingly immune from prosecution, if not from notoriety, retired to his country estate to concentrate on composing. Meantime, he was rehabilitated. In 1593, he was allowed to make a very advantageous second marriage to another aristocratic lady, Leonora d'Este. But his lingering ill repute served only, as it still does, to draw attention to the voluptuous mannerism of his music. Here's one of his sacred works, a penitent motet with a text which may, or may not, have had special meaning for Gesualdo. Tribulationem et dolorem. I have known torment and pain, and I have called upon the Lord.